You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is someday in either February or March. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live-ish in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Ladies and gentlemen, I don't know what day it is. I'm not even 100% sure what month it is. Could be March. Could be February. Probably March. So what am I doing here? Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not here. We have pre-recorded this intro in the event that, well, not in the event, for when the inevitable event of the birth of my second child takes place. And because you're hearing it, it means that I am on paternity leave. How long will it be? Probably not that long. I may take a little more time later, but for the next day or two or three or four, maybe five, depending on which day you're listening to this, we will have a series of either guest hosts or pre-recorded interviews that we've done, or archive shows. And in just a moment, you will hear the dulcet tones of Matt and Michael, the Majority Report producers, who will explain whether it's a guest host or some archived interviews from the first Majority Report or from this version of the Majority Report, or interviews that I pre-recorded over the past couple of weeks, or interviews done by some of my friends. Not to say that Michael and Matt aren't my friends. I'm friendly with them. But let's not get carried away. So I leave it now to Matt and Michael to give you the information. They'll tell you what the date is. They'll tell you what the status is of the birth of my second child. And they'll let you know what to expect on today's program. So see you soon.
Hi, my name is Tina Dupuy, and I'm filling in for Sam today. And today is March 12th, 2013. And the status of the child is that he's incredibly punctual. He was supposed to come out March 7th, came out March 7th, so that's fantastic. Let this all be a lesson to you. Use a condom, or I will take over your show. Like I said, my name is Tina Dupuy. I'm the editor-in-chief of thecontributor.com. Check us out, thecontributor.com. You can go sign up. We are about to launch out of beta. Very exciting. But to start the show, let's go to – we had some breaking news last night, and that is Judge Milton Tingling, yes, his name is Milton Tingling, shot down the ban of sodas over 16 ounces in New York City. Now, so it was going to go into effect today. Of course, it's not going to, because the judge said that it was capricious and arbitrary and it didn't apply to all restaurants equally. Here's the thing with this. What is now called soda ban. As soon as it was called soda ban, it was kind of doomed. Because A, it's not banning soda. It's banning giant buckets of soda, where you can get those giant buckets of soda just in smaller containers. The other thing that I think is really weird is that everyone keeps on talking about how this, you know, the Big Gulp is back, the Big Gulp is in peril. Well, the Big Gulp actually wasn't ever on an issue because 7-Eleven wasn't covered under this ban. So 7-Eleven could still serve you a big bathtub full of Mountain Dew in the city of New York, as even if the judge had not ruled against it. So there were some kind of weird things. Milk products were, if it had 50% or more milk in it, you could get more than 16 ounces of it, but a Frappuccino has 60% ice, and that has a lot of calories. So there was some weird things about it. But the problem with this bill is not that it has weird things in it. The problem is that we have an obesity epidemic, and this is what Bloomberg, when he gave his press conference yesterday, can we play that clip, what he said?
But as far as we've come, there is one public health crisis that has grown worse and worse over the years, and that is obesity. Obesity is a leading cause of diabetes, heart disease, and other deadly killers. We've tackled it by promoting exercise and healthy eating and by supporting green markets and encouraging bodegas to carry fresh fruits and vegetables. But the fact is, as we all know, that is not enough. If we are serious about fighting obesity, we have to be honest about what causes it, and we have to have the courage to tackle it head on. 70,000 people will die of obesity in America this year. 5,000 people in New York City will die of obesity. Now, the best science tells us that sugary drinks are a leading cause of obesity. Some people say, just talk about the problem, raise awareness, and hope that results in change. But it's not enough to talk, and it's not enough to hope. We have a responsibility as human beings to do something to save each other, to save the lives of ourselves, our families, our friends, and all of the rest of the people that live on God's planet.
Okay, well, here's the thing. Doing nothing has gotten us nowhere. 5,000 people, 5,000 New Yorkers each year die of obesity-related deaths. The thing that I find most disingenuous about the obesity epidemic and the restaurant industry's response to this and the food industry's response to this is basically that if we just exercise more, if people just got off the couch and there were sidewalks, if we went out and we actually were more active, then we would not have to deal with this. The fact of the matter is if you drink a soda that's 800 calories, it takes 8 miles of running to get to work off those calories. I think that this soda ban actually addresses the real problem when it comes to obesity. And when it comes to public health hazards, the whole idea is harm reduction, right? A very pragmatic approach. And I think that this had it. Now, there's been a visceral reaction. When this first passed, New Yorkers were 50-50, 50% for the ban, 50% against. But there was a real visceral reaction for the people opposed to it that it was about freedom, right? So, like, they're telling me that I can't have this. So therefore, I want it more. Or that if you say this is probably bad for you, somehow that makes you Stalin. And that, I think, is ridiculous. There's this kind of mythology out there in America where people want to think that they're homesteaders when they're really just consumers, and in this case, over-consumers. But what I like about this, and particularly because it's happening in New York, and I wrote a column about this back when this was first proposed, the Board of Health, and this is also what Judge Tingling, there's a Mrs. Tingling out there. I hope there's a Mrs. Tingling Jr. Out there, Judge Milton Tingling. Also what he said is that the Board of Health doesn't have the authority to do this, that it really needed to go through the city council. Well, the Board of Health in New York, this is the example that I used. In 1899, this is true, there was, for some strange and ridiculous reason, the most popular way, or a very popular way, of committing suicide was downing carbolic acid. And it was this kind of like bizarre trend that happened in Lower Manhattan, where people would go into the drugstore, a for a dime, they could get enough carbolic acid, which is like paint thinner, to kill a handful of people. They would go to the bars or whoever they were mad at, and they would take these shots of carbolic acid, and it was this horrible, disgusting, freaky death. And there was 238 suicides in New York City in 1899, and it was widely available, this carbolic acid. So the Department of Health, the same one that banned 16-ounce sodas, went and decided that what they could do for harm reduction purposes is just make carbolic acid not available unless you had a doctor's note. So, of course, there was no outcry that people were less free. No one was freaking out about it. Somehow this was the nanny state. But what happened was, in 1900, the following year, there were fewer than a handful, according to reports, of suicides by carbolic acid. So the whole idea that Bloomberg uses the analogy of lead paint, which the free market would all have us, you know, having lead paint, because then it would be up to, us to decide whether or not we wanted to live somewhere with lead paint. But no, it's the government who has made that less frequent in our lives. So the idea that all we have to do is just do nothing and then everybody's going to do what's best for them is not true, because, well, we live on an island, but you are not an island. And your obesity and your health actually impacts the rest of us. It leads to higher rates with our insurance companies. And if you go to the ER instead of having insurance, that's a whole other issue. But I think this is not a cure-all by any stretch of the imagination, but I think that it is public policy. And I know, Matt, you disagree with me, but I think this is public policy, which, you know, that's okay. You can be wrong. It's fine. I'm sure you're a nice person in theory, but this is not going to cure all. It's not going to make us all thinner. It's not going to make us all happy and healthy and wonderful. But I do think that it's akin to the smoking ban, which everyone complained about when it first happened. But now I quit smoking because of a smoking ban. And now I'm like, I'm more than happy. I think we should use drones on smoke. Like, let's not have them anywhere. Like, let's just do this.
No, I think the smoking ban is completely different from this. I mean, it's one thing to just ban smoking because in certain areas, because smoking affects the people who surround you. You're making people unhealthy when you smoke because they have to inhale the smoke from your cigarette. That's not the same with sugary drinks.
If you sit next to someone who is really fat, then that's secondhand fat.
Yeah, I'm not going to gain weight because I'm sitting next to someone.
Well,
but
you're coming from a place where this is personal to you because you like sugary drinks and you're not overweight.
But see, I'm not.
But it's not like you can't get 32 ounces of soda under this.
It's not even
ban.
So much though that I'm against the ban. It's more so that I think this is just Bloomberg finding a way to address an issue in a way where he can say, oh, look, I tackled that issue, but he doesn't want to get to the real underlying cause of the problem, and that's poor people can't afford healthy food.
Well, in fairness, he did encourage bodegas to have fresh fruit, like the food deserts that exist in New York. That has been a part of his policy. Like, I mean, just in fairness to Bloomberg, because I mean, and also just a disclaimer: for every one thing that Bloomberg does that I like, he does two things that make me crazy.
Well,
I cut in and say that in fairness to Bloomberg is the first time I've heard that term in the show. That was amazing.
I agree with you. I agree that there's a myriad of issues, but I think this is a great start. I think that like actually going after like empty calories and saying, look, over 16 ounces is ridiculous. Come on, it really is.
Let me get back to the smoking analogy though, because you're off base with that, Matt. Because you're right. In the immediate circumstances, somebody smoking next to you has a much more immediate effect than somebody drinking a soda, other than drinking a gulp soda is kind of disgusting to watch on the street, in fairness. But in terms of the long-term health consequences that person has and the overall drain on the system, that definitely does affect us.
Right.
So I agree with what you're saying more broadly, that obviously there are fundamental issues here that Bloomberg isn't great on. But there's no doubt that other people's dietary habits and what they do with their health has an effect on the overall health system, on spending, on emergency room visits, and on, you know, everything, airplane safety. So I mean, okay, there's no doubt. You have to look at it in a more long-term way. That was a very libertarian point of view, Matt.
I guess that was very – but I mean, you mentioned this island before, and I mean – is there any better model for income inequality other than Manhattan? And Bloomberg just refuses to address that issue. And to me, that is the main issue. I mean, that is why people are unhealthy, because they cannot afford other options.
Because they have food insecurity. Right. Well, like I said, this is not a cure-all. And I don't think that, like, it's an either-or type of thing. Like, we can't ban sodas over 16 ounces. And then we also can't make sure that people have healthy food.
Oh, no, I'm definitely not.
Like, you know what I mean? I don't think it's an either-or type of thing. But I think that when it comes to public policy and when it comes to, like, how we want what we want the government to do for us, I think disincentivizing bad behavior that ultimately affects all of us is – Like I said, harm reduction. I think that's it's a very reasonable policy. I don't think that anyone is adversely affected. This is what I disagree with, that somehow these small business owners, right, now, like, get them up on the cross here, that they are somehow – and I also heard this on the news, which made me laugh. It's not only small business owners. It's small business owners and minority business owners. Oh. That they are going to be adversely affected, that their bottom line is going to be affected by this. And that's what I think is completely wrong and just kind of silly.
My main issue with it is just that I think this is Bloomberg's way of wiping his hands clean and saying, look, my administration did something.
Well, but that's what happens every time a politician does anything. They can wipe their hands.
That's what policy making is.
Look, we did something, and here I'm standing on my record. Who doesn't say that we did something is Obama, who, like, actually does stuff and then never brings it up again. And we all are sat there going, well, why are the Republicans able to say that he you know, increased the deficit and, like, he increased spending, when what he did was he put wars on the books? Why doesn't he bring that up? He actually does things and then he just never mentions them again and lets his critics kind of shape a narrative. But Bloomberg doesn't do that.
Can I just say that was an amazing segue into another story? Yes, that was great.
Yeah, that was good. That was a masterful segue.
Good. If I was segueing into our next story, that would be masterful. Otherwise, that was a tangent. So
Tangents and segues.
Thank you for giving me credit where credit was not due.
Maybe I should answer you as Obama.
Oh, please do it. Because you're off camera, so it might actually really work. Right.
I'll put up on YouTube later. I'll put up a picture of Obama.
Okay, excellent. Okay, go ahead, Michael.
I think we're choreographing everything. I did do that. That's a fair point. What Tina said with regard to the budget was that, in contrast to previous administrations, we did not put contingency spending overseas on the book. Now, that doesn't mean that I agree with what Mayor Bloomberg's doing, but I'm open to the idea. And that's what we should all be open to, the ideas here in Washington. Look, that's what I came here to do. So I'm going to go take Sasha and Malia to the greengrocer.
Well, thank you very much for agreeing with me, Obama.
That is excellent. That is Michael, and he is available for children's parties.
Very soothing.
As long as your children are blind and can't see what he looks like in person. Okay.
Like, you know,
the opposite of Obama.
Impressions.
Right.
The opposite of Obama. I'm a Semitic Obama.
No. Yeah. No, because we are not done with Bloomberg, folks. Because there was a Brooklyn riot last night. Let me get this story up.
And here's a good contrast of Bloomberg caring about the lives of some people.
Did you ever see the taking of the Pelham 123?
Yes.
Did you ever watch? You both have seen this. Okay, so
no.
I guess there's a remake. Don't watch the remake. This is the original one in the 70s. But my favorite part about this, and this is the segue into another Bloomberg story. There's hostages that take a subway car. Is the premise of the taking of the Pelham 123, and when it happens, it just so happens to be when the mayor has the flu, and so they go to Gracie Mansion and they say, "Mayor, you know, this is there are hostages, and we have these hijackers who took a subway car," and the mayor's aide said, "You know, everyone hates the mayor in this story because New Yorkers, it's like a pastime with us, right?" So the mayor's aide goes, "You know, you have to go down there and you have to talk to the hijackers." And he's like, "I don't want to get shot." And the mayor's aide says, "Oh, no, you're not going to get shot." And the mayor says, "So they're from out of town?" right. And then the chief of police is down there, and you know, and they're gonna give the hostages money, and the chief of police is there, and there's a crowd of people around the subway station, and then all this crowd of people, like in unison, all start collectively booing, and the chief of police is like, oh, the mayor must be here. So I say that as a premise to like that, you know, everybody loves to hate on the, you know, but Bloomberg makes it especially easy, especially with his policing policies that are I do want to say are not as egregious as I say Oakland. I mean, I covered the Occupy movement. I went to 8 different occupations in 2 countries, and probably the most egregious when it came to community policing, or more specifically the lack thereof, was Oakland, where they have not been community policing for the last 30 years. If a cop gets out of their car, they're going to arrest you. It's really, really bad. It started really with the crack epidemic and has not let up. And they've had some serious problems there. And that's why it really got very ugly there very quickly when it came to the occupiers. Now, that being said, if you want to demoralize and kind of outrage community, just, implement stop and frisk. Just randomly stop people and who may or may not look suspicious. People who may not look suspicious are even more outraged, because people who are not dressed, you know, who would go out of their way just to like walk down the street in New York City are getting stopped. So that kind of harbors resentment against the NYPD. But I will tell you about this story. This happened in East Flatbush. It's Kamani Gray was a 16-year-old who was shot 11 times by 2 undercover officers. 11 times. We were talking about this before the show. It's like 7 times, but like 11 times when there's 2 police officers and there's one kid who's 16, who may or may not have been armed. There are 2 different conflicting stories. One said that he was trying to show that he didn't have a gun. Others, the police said that it looked like he was going for a gun. I guess they found a gun, but there was the police officers have been put on administrative leave, but they have not. There's been no. They said that there's no evidence that they acted inappropriately. Well, you know, the bottom line is there was a 16-year-old who was shot 11 times by the NYPD. And, of course, last night you have what's being called a riot in Brooklyn. There were people who showed up and chanting, NYPD, KKK, how many kids will you kill today? And then they started throwing garbage and empty bottles at the church, which, like, led to, like, you know, basically led to the melee last night.
The interesting thing is I was sort of following it online even before it started getting all the coverage with when people started throwing things. It was very much a common protest, a vigil, and then it turned into a protest with a march to the precinct in East Flatbush. And I didn't see the term Brooklyn riots used until the first sightings of police in riot gear showing up. So it's very much the way the police are portraying things.
Okay, but like, were people throwing stuff? Because this is and were they throwing trash and bottles first, and then the riot gear?
No, because I was reading that they were throwing it at the police who were going into the apartment buildings there, the housing there, without any warrant. They were just going in looking for people who were throwing things at them. So I mean, the cops showed up first. Like, things weren't just being thrown at stores or anything like that. There was no rioting until the police showed up.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, that
And even then, though, can you even consider just people throwing things at police a full-on – like, that's not a riot.
No, that's – but also throwing stuff at the police is not a nonviolent protest either. You know, well, once you start like throwing
emotions
stuff
are high. A
16-year-old,
right. No,
I, and yeah. I'm not saying it's not understandable. Like, I mean, I get it. And like, you know, and protesting that kind of stuff and the resentment. That's why you community police. That's why you have boots on the ground and people who, you know, live in the neighborhood. Police in the neighborhood live in the neighborhood. And that's another policy anyway, that you know, that police are not able to afford to live in the neighborhoods in New York City. And so there's this disconnect between what's going on in the neighborhood and the people who are there to police. Like, there's tons of problems with that. But however, throwing stuff at police, and it's like, you can't, and this is what, and again, back to the Occupy movement, they were like, oh yeah, we're nonviolent except for we destroy property. And like, there were people, you know, throwing a bottle of urine at a reporter. That's not a nonviolent thing to do. Like, that's an assault. That's disgusting and horrible.
Where did that happen?
Oakland, of course.
That happened in Oakland. Yeah, the Oakland. It seemed like Oakland was.
But
the
they broke into City Hall. I mean,
see,
they did a lot of things.
Both
that...
ways in Oakland. My read of Oakland, and obviously you know more than I do from covering it, both extremes are most represented in Oakland. Like, it was the most genuinely questionable Occupy, and the police response was by far the most abusive and out of control. That's true in both directions.
You got it right on the head. And that's exactly what, when I was there, I was like, this is the most disgusting, horrible, unclean, awful occupation. After I had been to, this was like my second to the last one that I had visited. And it was so disgusting. And you could see why, you know, and they were like a couple of feet away from the Chamber of Commerce, who of course didn't want them to be there because it was an eyesore and they weren't kind of bringing up the city of Oakland. They were really, you know, they were just kind of, you know, making a wreck of the place. And there were no good guys and bad guys in that whole scenario. There just weren't. You kept on looking for someone who could go, oh, I really support them for whatever reason. And you couldn't say that about the cops because they were clearly in the wrong and they did a bunch of stuff that was not cool. One was that, you know, they had people coming in from different districts and different cities who they weren't communicating with each other, and they used a ridiculous amount of force for what was there, because, you know, if you live, say, in San Leandro or the adjacent places near Oakland, you think of Oakland as being this really awful, hostile, violent place, mainly because it is. There's a lot of evidence to support that suspicion, and so, but they used way too much force and military force in the very beginning, and but you also couldn't go there. And I mean, I was there, and you couldn't go to that occupation and go like, and go to that Occupy camp or whatever, and look at it and say they're doing great things here, because they weren't.
That's what it sounded like to
me.
I'm
no,
just gonna
you got make it right. You
one
got
more
it absolutely
Bloomberg
right.
Joke.
Well, please,
I need to. I need
please
to just make
do
a more
it.
Bloomberg joke. I was when you were describing that movie. The Pelham, was it Pelham what?
Taking Pelham, Pelham 123.
Taking a Pelham 123. I was thinking that if it was not a subway car, because subway cars go across the city, obviously, but if it was like a local bus out in the Bronx or something, Bloomberg just would have been like, what? There's a hostage? What? You're calling
but
me
But it
for
was
this?
In the Bronx, wasn't it?
No. Well, I mean, no.
But I mean,
the
subway affects the whole city. I'm
yes.
saying Bronx.
Yes. Okay, yes. Bloomberg, okay. You're saying
like,
I know what you're saying.
You're
yes.
talking about a hostage crisis in where? Excuse me?
Yeah, or Staten Island, right.
Trying to promote a friggin', you know, the Lion King right now. What are you doing?
But I mean, what's interesting about this story and then the soda story happening the same day is Bloomberg cares about the health of some people, yet children are being killed on the streets by his private army, which he called them, and he doesn't give a crap about that.
You know, I just don't think it's an either or thing. I mean, I think it's interesting that both of these things happened today in the life and the administrative, the Bloomberg administration. But I just don't think that one really has anything. I think that his policing, I think that he can be wrong on his policing policies, and I think that he can be right on his soda ban policies, and that's politics. You know, I mean, like I said, for everything that I like that Bloomberg does, two other things make me crazy.
I think you're right about that, but I'm curious to ask you about is the distinction between Giuliani and Bloomberg in terms of this stuff. Because I feel like with Giuliani, and granted, I was young, you know, I'm not up on this, but it seemed like there was a lot of cases of police brutality, obviously, around Giuliani. And in a certain way, it was like very personalized. Like Giuliani would come out and do something like release Amadou Diallo's juvenile record after he'd been killed by NYPD. And then Bloomberg came in, and Bloomberg kind of said, look, I'm a more – especially when he first came in, he branded himself as a more conciliatory guy. And in a way, some of his policing policies seem almost a little bit more insidious because they're kind of described like bureaucratically. In a way, like, look, stop and frisk isn't personal. It's not racist. It's just, it's like the
we
soda
do this to
ban.
Everybody.
It's
yeah.
the rational thing to do. So I think in some ways, because I don't have this person, I'm sure Bloomberg's not happy that a 16-year-old kid was killed, and I'm sure he'll look into it, and I'm obviously, but the structure of the policy and the way he justifies it kind of lays the groundwork for this stuff to be normalized in the long term, because it's not like, oh, that's an aberration, or maybe Giuliani's a little out of control, and we need to calm that down. It's the same way that you pick up garbage in a certain way, you should harass certain communities in a certain way, and it's not personal. And that seems kind of problematic.
So the question was about the contrast between yes. Giuliani.
Is that contrast right?
I think that the main difference between Giuliani and Bloomberg is that Giuliani kind of saw something beyond being mayor of New York. You know, he kind of like had his eye on the White House, like everything that he
delusional.
Did. But he was, but like he, but he really was pandering and still continues to pander to the Republican Party and kind of like give them a big sloppy kiss all the time, as Marilyn or not. My favorite thing about Giuliani, like my favorite thing about Giuliani, was that he was a crossdresser. But also, my favorite thing about New York is that he wasn't the first cross-dressing mayor New York has ever had. But that's a whole other story.
Who was the other one?
Well, he was actually technically the governor before it was a state, and it was Hyde, and he was like a cousin of Queen Elizabeth. It was this whole thing, but like it's. You know, the portrait of him is him dressed in drag. It's hilarious. Anyway. I think that Giuliani had an eye on the had an eye on the White House, and so he kind of had to do everything that entails, which is suck up to the Republican Party. I think that Bloomberg doesn't have that ambition, and so he's able to do things. Like I said, he does one thing and two other things make me crazy. But I love what he's done on guns. I love that he's like not shied away from the whole issue of guns before. It was almost radical to watch. I wish that weren't the word for him. But before Sandy Hook, when no one could talk, it was like you just could not talk about gun control. You could not talk about gun control whatsoever. No one could talk about handguns. No one could talk about rounds. It just was a completely taboo subject in American politics. That there you have Bloomberg, who's the mayor of the largest city in the country, and he was able to talk about it pretty brazenly, and it politically it did nothing to him. He didn't have any kind of repercussions from that. So like, and I think that he's been able to actually start conversations and change and completely be independent of the Republican Party, whereas Giuliani was kind of like, you know, I mean, he was playing ball.
He was playing it. So it's actually interesting, though.
And the way he played ball was like by the personal stuff, like by the very like, you know, forgive me that this is sound right, but the mafioso, like, you know, we're gonna fix you good. You mess with us. Kind
we
of thing.
Apologize to all Italian listeners.
I apologize.
Horrible. And anybody in Staten Island or New Jersey.
You know, right. I don't even live here. I live in Connecticut. I don't know.
Don't
look for me.
We'll be we got Tina covered.
Yeah, right. No one will be able to find a blonde in New York City.
I'll just tell you just one really quick thing though about Bloomberg and the
Please.
Gun issue. Because I actually was in Connecticut a couple weeks ago, and I was talking with some, or maybe a couple months ago, actually, yeah, before this, before Sandy Hook. We were talking about Bloomberg, and this friend of mine, she said, look, I don't like him in a lot of ways, but I really hope when he leaves office that he'll continue fighting on the gun issue. And I said, yeah, I hope he keeps putting his money into that. But as a spokesperson, I think he's the worst spokesperson for gun control that's imaginable. And then this guy who was sitting at the edge of the bar and has just said, hey, you know, and he's a big, you know, burly dude. He's like, I'm sorry, I couldn't help but overhearing that. And then he pointed at me and he's like, your friend is exactly right. I don't ever want to hear that little rich. And then he used a bunch of words I couldn't use. Ever talk about anything that I should do with guns or anything else. He has a silver spoon in his mouth and he's everything I don't like about modern politics. So I wonder if he's contaminating the gun control brand in some ways, even as he's taking a gutsy position on it, but he might be a problematic messenger.
Yeah, but I don't agree with like that perfect has to be the enemy of good,
right.
You know, or good enough. Like I think that someone being out there and being a spokesperson for this movie, I think that someone is better than no one. And really, no one has had the courage to do this. No one. And if they did, they're not incumbents. You know, they're not in office. So I think like, you know, and now he, you know, I mean, there's other people who actually can come out and say that they are not for the NRA. But I mean, you had to, even a Democrat, I mean, and I say this more about Democrats than Republicans, like Democrats who had to be, you know, pro NRA and be in their, what was his name, who had to shoot the, go on television and shoot.
Manchin, are you talking about?
Was it Manchin?
The dude in West Virginia.
Yeah.
He shot the climate bill.
Oh, that, yeah.
He shot the
yes.
climate bill, right.
That was an excellent ad, by the way.
No, it was fantastic. And we would have had it queued up right now had this was not been a tangent. But you know, like that we have to let we have to be pro guns. That you couldn't even and in fairness to you had to be a gun fanatic to even talk about guns before Sandy Hook. You had to start every single conversation about guns saying, "I love guns. I own guns. Guns are great. I hunt every other day." And, you know, I mean, you had to love guns. You couldn't come from the position before Sandy Hook. You couldn't come from the position of saying, "Look, I don't like guns. I don't like being shot. I don't like losers with guns. I don't like people who have tempers having guns. That makes me feel uncomfortable. I don't think that children should have guns. You know, I am."
It's an interesting new like gun control questioner. I like that. Like, yeah. I could see mine. I don't like being shot. I like winners with guns. No, I'm just kidding.
But like, you know, the whole like the only thing that's going to solve a bad. And I think the people who have done the best about this, as far as like really kind of illuminating the issue that we have with urban guns, because I'm of the opinion that I think the assault weapon bans is a bit of a red herring, right? So if, and you brought this up, Mac, saying that you did something just so you could say that you did something, and I think that that's the assault weapons ban, where it's really not going to change a lot when it comes to gun deaths, because the main gun deaths, the most people who die from gun deaths in this country die from handguns. They don't die from being shot from an automatic assault weapon. Not that people don't meet their end by that way. However, the majority are by handguns, and then the right wing loves to giggle about all of the gun deaths that happen in Chicago, for example. Now, in Chicago, they have, because Chicago has really strict gun laws. They have you can't have open carry and other, you know, they have gun laws. They have gun control laws. Well, Cook County, the county that Chicago sits in, doesn't, and they did a study. Of all of the guns that were involved in crimes, of they figured out where those guns came from, and over 50% of them came from Cook County, and it was like some ridiculous percentage, upwards of 20, just from one store, which basically means that there's straw purchases happening of handguns, right? Of people who just walk in there and they buy a bunch of guns one day because they can legally buy the guns, and then they go there the next day and they still are able to buy more guns. And the guy who owns the place, he just kind of pretends not to notice because they have legal immunity, right? The gun people who now, because of an act of in 2005, because of an act of Congress, or 2006, excuse me, because of an act of Congress, you are not, you if you sell a gun to someone or just make it available where they could shoplift it, as in the case of the DC sniper, then there are no civil repercussions. So I can like just sell and sell and sell, even if I think that you are, you know, going to do something with it, something illegal, or it's really obvious that you are going to go sell it, etc. That gun purchaser or that gun seller is not legally going to have any trouble whatsoever because of the Bush administration. But they found out that that's how everyone is getting their guns in Chicago. And there was This American Life, where there was a high school that had 29 gun deaths, or 29 students were shot in one year, and I think like 9 of them died. So they went in and they had 4 reporters to go in and talk to these kids and see what was going on within this school in Chicago. And the creepy thing about it is that the school is really small. It was like 500 students, and that's like a fraction of the size of my high school. And so the opening, and this is a 2-part series in This American Life, and you can go listen to it. But what it was so fascinating to me was that they were not these drug dealing gangs from The Wire. You know, everyone assumes that They, you know, they are making a lot of money. That's why all these kids are getting shot, because they're fighting over territory. And really, the story at this particular school, because the all of the drug dealers and all of the heads of these gangs were arrested and taken, they were all in prison. What was left was a bunch of kids with guns who were essentially not in gangs, but what you would call a clique. So they were settling, you know, people stealing their girlfriend or whatever, or looking at them wrong in the hallways with shooting. And you were, you became a part of this gang or clique because of where you lived, what block you lived on. And so it was essentially like high school, but with everyone armed, which is a utopia if you're an NRA supporter, because you think that we're all going to be really, you know, no one's going to get raped, no one's going to be assaulted. Everybody's going to be a lot safer the more guns everyone has, because no one's going to ever do anything because more people have guns. And of course, that the data and any kind of rational, reasonable person will find that that opposite of that is true, and nothing makes that more apparent than this school in Chicago.
Where's the push for Saudi Arabia and Iran to get nukes from you guys?
Well, yeah, that's the thing. I mean, we are at for gun control when it comes to other countries. You know, we don't think that everybody should have all the weapons that they want. And also the militia, who believe that the reason why they have to have guns is to protect themselves from the military. Well, the military has nuclear weapons, bunker busters, daisy cutters. And we don't let civilians have that, so that argument's ridiculous.
Well, they've already made some compromises, Tina. That's
oh, yeah. Right. They're bringing compromise to the table. Yeah, because the right wing totally does that. That's a thing that the right wing invented, right?
You know, we already said we're not going to have daisy cutters, so it's time to relax a little bit.
And this is America, guys. This is America. We got to have our—
– You're pronouncing it wrong. It's Merca.
Merca, sorry. Merca. Merca.
I don't know where your accent comes from. It's Merca.
I'm from Queens. What
clearly.
I
the fourth coolest.
You're not American.
I'm not American at
you're
all.
You're not American. You're from Merca. Queens.
Some weird—
– If you were American, it'd be Kings. I got nothing.
Merca. I'll tell you, the one last thing on the gun topic, which amazed me. There was this piece in The New Yorker, I think, a year ago. Because another thing, obviously, our guns flood Mexico.
Yes.
Right? So we're actually – when we read about that drug war going on there, a lot of those guns are coming from us. And the author of the piece, I think it was Steve Cole, he talked about this gun shop in Arizona where heavy artillery went out. Yeah. And he said, by the logic that our drone program operates in Pakistan, and he wasn't being facetious. He was actually being really sincere. He's like, look, some people in Pakistan are a threat to U.S. security, right? By that same logic, Mexico should have drones hovering over these gun shops in Arizona. And it's just like, absolutely correct logic.
So, yeah. Absolutely. Well, I mean, and it goes back to that the NRA is not about our freedoms, and it's not about us being able to – it's not about personal freedom whatsoever. They kind of tacked on the Second Amendment. Of course, they omit the part where it says well-regulated militia. They completely omit that when it comes to the Second Amendment. But they've kind of tacked on that part of the Constitution to kind of give the illusion that they are actually for personal freedoms and for us to like walk around and be cool. But what they really are for the freedom for corporations. Like any other lobbyist that goes into Washington, it's when they talk about freedom, it's very tongue-in-cheek, because it's not about individual freedom. It's about freedom for corporations, and freedom for corporations to pollute, freedom for corporations to flood our streets with guns, and foreign countries with guns, with immunity, with legal, absolute blanket immunity from the legal system in every way, you know, to like to be able to put harmful products to, you know, feed us bad food, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's why lobbyists are not there just because they want us to be free and happy. They're there because they want corporations to
Tina
not have to pay so much
shedding
money.
A lot of our illusions here on the show today.
You guys, you had so many illusions before I got here. Finally.
I gotta just say, with my 10 AR-15s, I am a one-man militia. I don't know what your time a one-man regulated militia.
Well, rel regulated was inserted by Obama.
I like how you tried
clear.
To have a southern accent there. It was really bad. It was really bad. It's like when southerners try to sound like a New Yorker.
I thought that was so really bad it was good. That sounded right
to me. No, that's your Obama impersonation. No. I'm saying I want you to I want you to do the rest of the show as Obama. Please. All right. Do we take a break?
I think that's it for today's first half of the show. Wow.
Is it?
Yes. And Tina came in today.
But I want to show this.
She was so prepared, and even then she said to us, "You know, I don't know if I have enough." And I, we were just me and Michael just sat here. We were like, "My God, you have enough."
No. Okay, for the record, I want this to go on the record. You said, because I brought in like 6 stories, and then I have a couple of other notes, and they were like, "Well, normally we have 30 stories, but maybe we'll just get to those." That's why I was panicked. I was like, "Oh my God, there's 30 stories."
But out of those 30 stories, Sam usually gets to maybe 2.
All right.
So,
I said you just brought the actual number that will be covered. So you're good.
We didn't even get to that.
I think we were even wrong.
We didn't even get to that.
Well, we could get to the other 5.
I just talked about guns. You know, I didn't even. Can we really? I want to talk about Jeb Bush.
Let's do a little Jeb Bush, then we'll wrap up the first half.
Like, okay, because I
don't have to rush through it, but we'll just do it. We got it.
Okay.
Because this. Take a deep breath, Tina.
This. Do we? You know, if we had the button for the "Here Comes the Chief" music, that would be epic. But we so don't. Okay, so here. So play the clip if you could, so we can just cut this up. That word. Play now. This is so. Jeb Bush just had a book come out, and he's and the media is kind of, and we're all going to pretend that he's the Marilyn of the Munsters, which is the Bush family. Right? He's nothing like the other Bushes. But could you play what he said about Jeb Bush said about his brother at the RNC? Can we play that clip?
I've been so blessed to be part of a family that has committed its life to public service. My granddad, my grandfather, and my father have been incredible role models for me and served our country honorably. And my brother, well, I love my brother.
Now, I could be wrong, but I think that is the closest anyone got to mentioning Bush, George Bush, W. Bush, the entire RNC. I was there. There were a lot of very cranky white people. It was kind of awesome. They were like, I keep on running into these people that were like, "Oh, we showed our diversity." And I was like, all 3 of them were on stage, you know, like they weren't actually in the reaction shots were the most telling. But, so now Jeb Bush he released this book, about, you know, immigration policy because he lives near Florida, which is completely disingenuous, because Cubans get amnesty as soon as they come to America. They get automatic. It's amazing. Since the 90s, they've had to have what they're calling dry feet. They have to not be in the water. But basically, if you are a Cuban national and you get to this country, you get automatic immunity and you get in front of the line to get citizenship. And the U.S. government has spent billions of dollars to assist Cuban nationals because it was a way to, you know, screw over Castro and have a brain drain happen on that island, which, you know, the argument can be whether that was successful or not, but that has been our immigration policy. So the governor of Florida coming out somehow having this an opinion as to what we would do about Mexicans and Central Americans who come to this country illegally. It's kind of just as ridiculous as Marco Rubio somehow being, you know, their token Latino, who apparently among Latinos, Hillary Clinton is beating the pants off him by like 15 points in the latest poll. But here's the thing about Jeb Bush. I think that the Republican Party has been more than happy to not mention that George Bush ever happened, that he exists, that any of their policies ever came to fruition and were disastrous for the country. And so Jeb Bush kind of wants to come out and be, you know, the Bush who never was. And that is impossible, I submit, without having, let's call it a come to Jesus moment when it comes to George Bush. Without them going, you know, having some form of contrition, saying this is what happened, this was wrong, they either have to double down and basically say that everything that George Bush ever did was awesome and we want to repeat it again, which no one wants to, not even Republicans want to, or they have to like have some kind of moment where they admit that they made a huge mistake. There's no way of him going about that. Right?
I agree. I mean.
Yeah. He like there's his like this whole I'm going to have a book that comes out and then suddenly people are going to start buzzing about me for 2016. It's not going to happen.
Well, the other thing about Jeb Bush is that he's also just George W. Bush is a better politician.
Yes.
In the sense of he's much more a much more engaging speaker. He's much has a much higher emotional intelligence. I mean, Jeb Bush is like.
Are we talking about W?
I'm talking about emotional? W on the level of shaking hands, on the level of creating. I mean, if you watch Jeb Bush speak, he's got the name and the baggage, along with the consistency of Romney and the charisma of some guy who's on Morning Joe a lot that you can never remember his name. I mean,
that's
he's
really
incredibly dull.
But I really did get a Romney vibe from him on Chris Wallace. We can play that clip because like that's interesting. You should bring that up because that's exactly what because there's a lot of hostility. Look how hostile he is. This is Fox News. Like, there's no one who loves Jeb Bush more than Fox News. I mean, there's no one in the world who could possibly because why would you? But they're literally paid to love him. And like, let's watch this because it was incredibly Romney-esque where you don't know who your friends are. Go ahead.
Let me ask you a couple of more questions about the illogic of whether or not you would run in 2016. Some people say that obviously you're very proud of your family and proud of their accomplishments, but the question is, would it be a political burden? I think it's fair to say that when your brother left the presidency, he was somewhat unpopular. We looked around. The most recent poll shows that 46% view him favorably, 49% view him unfavorably. Do you think that there is any Bush baggage? Do you think that would be a problem?
No, I don't think there's any Bush baggage at all. I love my brother. I'm proud of his accomplishments. I love my dad. I am proud to be a Bush. And if I run for president, it's not because of something in my DNA that compels me to do it. It would be that it's the right thing to do for my family, that the conditions are right, and that I have something to offer.
Right. So it's like, you know, you think someone who has a silver spoon would be a little more, but being able to have a little more like self-reflection, but like in that interview, kind of hostile. At one point he's like, I'm at the Reagan Library, like that he got a chance to say Reagan,
That always wins everybody
exactly.
Over on that end of
like,
the
I
table.
Was like, why is he at the Reagan Library? And just so he could go, Reagan, remember Reagan, he's here. Gipper.
And he has no Reagan. I mean, that guy is as charismatic.
No, exactly. Exactly. I mean, but that's the thing. It's like, I want him to run just so we can, so we can actually have, Republicans are going to have to admit what a horrible president George W. Bush was.
I love Jed Bush.
He's a better painter.
That's get a hand in that, yeah. I love how Jeb Bush is kind of like, I'm not like my brother. I love him, but I'm not like my brother. Oh, so why would you run then? For my family? Oh, okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, yeah, we were talking about it. It's like his first answer was, for the good of the country. No. His first answer was like, for my family. It's like, okay, because you want to like, no. But yeah, so I want to run. Okay, so that's, I can't believe I talked that much. I would like to thank whoever made this coffee. For
still got another what?
God bless America.
35 minutes to go.
So yeah, we're gonna open up the phones. What
are
we doing?
We're gonna go into the better half of the show,
which is the members portion of the show.
Okay, you guys should probably.
I'm gonna just do this really quickly.
Yeah, so go ahead. You take it over.
Handle it,
Michael. Drink some more caffeine.
It is. Sam has a new baby, as we've been relentlessly plugging.
Yes.
He has a new mouth to feed, and he has another little mouth to feed besides this baby. He also has his other daughter. His daughter, man.
Yes, I know.
We've been putting it. Don't.
Yes,
don't
Sam is very fertile.
Yeah, Sam's very fertile, and with fertility comes
paternity
bills.
Leave.
Saul Arthur Cedar needs to eat, folks.
Yeah, I wouldn't put it that crassly. The point is, become a member.
Yes.
For as little as $10 a month, Go to our Amazon link. Buy things through Amazon on our link, which costs you nothing. I mean, come on. That's like the bare minimum.
Yes.
Tweet the show out. Facebook the show.
At Majority FM on Twitter. Facebook.com/Majority Report on Facebook. On YouTube, you can subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/Sam Cedar. Donate your account at donateyouraccount.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Follow Tina on Twitter.
Oh, yeah. You should follow me on Twitter. My last name is spelled D-U-P-U-Y. I know. I don't want to hear about it. It's French. What are you going to do? TinaDupuis.com.
We even have a French woman guest hosting for Sam. That's how well we do on this show. How have they not taken care
I'm
of
Cajun,
you well this week?
Which what? Is so not French.
You're what?
Cajun.
You're Cajun.
Cajun.
Oh, that's even better.
Yeah, no, Cajun, way better than French.
Cajun. Well, French with the whole like socialist European.
Can you speak a little of the?
No. No, I can't.
All right, everybody's spoiling.
I'm American.
To brand
I can't speak
here.
Other languages. I only speak American. Right. I barely speak American.
All right, we have an American.
We have an American.
But I think we've been doing pretty well, folks. We've been holding it down for Sam. Become a member. We'll see you in the better half of the show. What's the number? Actually.
Oh, yeah.
It is. The number is 646-257-3920. If you are a libertarian, you could call us on the libertarian line at 646.
I like 200... how we have to subsidize a line especially for the libertarians.
Oh, yeah. There's a libertarian.
Is that enough baiting?
Yeah, I don't know. 3,920. All right, folks. We will see you in the better half.
Thanks,
Sam
guys.
Beats you. I beat you. And now Tina will beat you. Any libertarian that wants the call.
Okay, everyone, we're going to tell Sam that I was awesome, by the way. So make sure to email.
Tweet out to Sam, email the show, let them.
Just lie, okay? That's all I ask.
I don't think it's a lie.
Oh, that's so sweet.